Twill, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on July 23rd, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. And my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Today we're joined by Elizabeth Weeks Leonard, a professor of law at the University of Georgia. Elizabeth teaches healthcare financing and regulation and healthcare fraud and abuse, and is a highly regarded health law scholar. Welcome, Liz.
Great to be here.
All right. Well, this is the place we come for talking about some knotty problems. And I don't think there's a knottier field of health law than fraud and abuse. Most of us manage to avoid teaching it. So you can imagine when we have an expert like Professor Leonard on the call, you know where we're going to go. So I wonder, before we get into some of your more recent research in this area and some of the more difficult contemporary problems, if you could just give our listeners sort of the overview of fraud and abuse, which I know is asking the impossible in the 5 or 6 minutes, but I think that would really help to sort of frame our discussion for today.
Okay, sounds great. So fraud and abuse, this area of law is particular to health law for a number of reasons. One being that the U.S. government and state governments pay for a lot of healthcare. So we're concerned about the public fisc and want to be sure that those monies are being spent appropriately. We're also concerned about fraud and abuse in the health law context because of themes that run throughout the curriculum, concerns about how healthcare is different from other sorts of products and services that we otherwise would subject to normal market principles. Fraud and abuse laws represent some real restrictions on those types of market arrangements that otherwise would operate. So when we talk about healthcare fraud and abuse, we really are thinking about primarily three federal laws and then some analogous state laws. The three major federal laws are the False Claims Act, the Anti-Kickback Statute, and the Stark Law, or the Physician and Self-Referral Statute. And each of these laws address concerns in healthcare billing as well as healthcare transactions or arrangements. The False Claims Act is aimed at healthcare providers who contract with the federal government to provide services to government healthcare program beneficiaries, primarily the Medicare and Medicaid programs. And essentially, the fraud and abuse law is not designed to operate in the health law context or healthcare industry. It really was aimed at munition suppliers and dates back to the Civil War. And the concern was that these private companies would submit bills to the government or provide supplies to the government and then seek payment for them when they were not proper. Well, all of that has transpired over the years into being a major tool of enforcement for healthcare fraud and abuse. That is to say, when healthcare providers are submitting bills to the federal government for Medicare and Medicaid patients, there's always this underlying concern about whether the claim may support a False Claims Act allegation. The second major federal law is the Anti-Kickback Statute, and that is aimed at a host of practices that I think most of us would consider appropriate and even desirable in other industries. Essentially, something like a frequent flyer program or a discount coupon or a fee to a business associate who makes a referral, some kind of referral fee. Those types of arrangements in the healthcare space may be unlawful for reasons that we can talk more about during the rest of the podcast. The third major federal law that is used to address fraud and abuse is the Stark Law, named for Pete Stark of California, who sponsored the legislation, also called the Physician Self-Referral Law. And in some ways, it overlaps with the Anti-Kickback Statute, but it is aimed particularly at physicians and prohibits their ownership interest in certain types of services, initially laboratory services, but now a host of other ancillary services. The concern behind the Stark Law, like the anti-kickback statute is that we don't want these sorts of financial arrangements to improperly influence healthcare providers' judgment about the appropriate services or the appropriate provider of services for their patients. So that's a nutshell of the three major statutes that I cover in my healthcare fraud and abuse class. And again, there are state analogs for several of those, and then there are a number of other general non-healthcare specific laws like the mail and wire fraud statutes, RICO conspiracy laws that also govern this space.
Oh, well, thank you, Elizabeth. I mean, that's a really terrifically well-structured and informative overview of this massive area of law. And I just wanted to start us out with a question that's a little bit more on the policy level, but will, I think, frame some of our later discussions about the ACA's effect on fraud and abuse law and some of these other areas. And that is that, you know, you mentioned with the anti-kickback statute in Stark, there's a real emphasis on separation between, say, providers and other entities, and an effort to make sure that the provider can exercise independent clinical judgment uninfluenced by monetary considerations. And yet it seems that so much of the ACA is premised on the development of vertically integrated delivery systems that would be precisely aimed at assuring that providers feel some sort of impact for wise or unwise decisions about how they delegate other services or tests. Has this sort of tension been informing a lot of the agency deliberations or court decisions or other academic literature here, or am I just making a mountain out of a molehill?
Well, no, I certainly think that's relevant to the extent that there are particularly recognized models of integration, most notably accountable care organizations or ACOs. The fraud and abuse laws specifically accept those, so they are removed from the concerns of the anti-kickback statute and the Stark law, as well as antitrust considerations by design. But with respect to other less particularly recognized forms of integration, I think that concern persists. And one of the, I think, the real challenges in the fraud and abuse area is that it's the government enforcement authorities are always seemingly one step behind the industry. So the industry recognizes certain models of delivery or certain types of business arrangements that are advantageous from a market perspective and that seem to operate within some gray areas in the regulations. They move forward with those types of arrangements to the extent that they're advantageous. And at some point, the government enforcement authorities become concerned, issue some sort of new policy or some sort of new guidance that suggests that those types of arrangements are not appropriate. And then the cycle begins again as the industry begins to identify other opportunities that don't run awry of the new guidance. So I think that that dynamic will surely continue, and maybe the space for industry innovation and, some would call it gaming, maybe narrowed by the under the Affordable Care Act. But I think that it's that again, that dynamic is likely to persist.
So I take that point about the this sort of rhythm that we're used to as health law people of the sort of the dissonance or the time gap between regulation and what the industry is doing. But let me ask, taking that into account, let me ask perhaps the most naive question possible. I mean, fraud and abuse law has been around for a long time. None of the things you're talking about are particularly new pieces of legislation, including, as you say, the FCA goes back forever. Yet, there's barely a week goes by that we don't see in the current awareness materials some massive settlement or an announcement by DOJ of large numbers of arrests and so on. Just over the last week, there's been a story about the CMS supercomputer which the fraud-busting computer, which the government claims was responsible for, what, 454 million recoveries. And then the HHS OIG comes back and says, well, actually, not so much. It's not that good. And then even more recently, HHS OIG has announced that they're starting a super fraud division of incredibly expert fraud router outers, pigs that know how to find the truffles, that are they're going to let loose on this. So my question is why is there this persistent, massive, or perception of massive fraud, or should we just keep it keep a sense of what percentage dollar figure this is compared to the overall health spend?
So whether this is just a is the problem getting worse, or is the enforcement getting better, maybe is another way of asking your question, right? Are we catching more of it, or is there more of it out there?
Right.
Yeah. I think yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it speaks to the complexity of the underlying healthcare laws and the reimbursement methodologies that are the basis for so much of these allegations of fraud. I think it also speaks to the complexity of the industry as well as the dollars available in the industry. I mean, in one view, this is for a healthcare provider navigating the terrain of the fraud and abuse laws is what are the costs of doing business. And it may be, certainly I think there are examples within the pharmaceutical industry that a pharmaceutical company can make a rational cost benefit analysis that we're just going to build in the cost of the potential cost of getting hit into our the cost of doing business. And that's cheaper than really trying to abide the law, which is so impossibly complex to begin with. But I think, certainly from the administration's perspective, I think that the problem is getting worse and that the enforcement is getting better. And so I think the administration's line would be that we are catching more of it through these additional enforcement authorities, more aggressive practices, and more aggressive crackdowns. There's all this rhetoric now of these strike forces and sorts of things that you hear about in other criminal contexts.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to discuss also about the sort of rhythm of fraud and abuse and other policy angles in health law is, it seems to me that, at least my recollection of when I taught healthcare finance and regulation, was that there was this sort of pattern where essentially Congress would try to tighten up the fraud and abuse laws, then under a sort of rule of lenity type of angle or a similar type of angle, the Supreme Court might come in and say, oh, wait a second, you know, this particular activity that you're trying to go after isn't really illegal, or you didn't make it clear enough, and then Congress makes the law even tighter. Did you see a similar dynamic like that in terms of the ACA's effect on fraud and abuse law, or another broader dynamic in terms of the ACA's adjustments to fraud and abuse?
Yeah, I think the ACA tries to cast a wider net, so clarify some pieces of the relevant statutes that make it easier for enforcement authorities, and identify more types of conduct as potentially raising fraud and abuse concerns. So I certainly think that's true. In one of the areas in particular that has providers quite concerned is the Affordable Care Act's 60-day rule. So there is now a provision of the Affordable Care Act that says any overpayment that a provider identifies must be returned to the government within 60 days. And if the provider fails to do so, that constitutes what the literature refers to as a reverse false claim. So a retention of an overpayment is a false claim for purposes of these laws. That 60-day rule has a number of different effects on providers. First and foremost, it essentially requires them to be vigilant about their practices because the way that the regulatory guidance has defined identified, and identified payment retained for 60 days is basically a knows or should have known, the same sort of reckless disregard that underlies the False Claims Act scienter requirement generally. So it's not sufficient for providers just to sit back and wait for the government to come to them. They must be aware and looking for instances of overpayments through their often very complex organizations. So that creates an added pressure for compliance. Additionally, other violations, such as a billing that violates the anti-kickback statute or a billing that violates the Stark Law, is also an overpayment or an improper payment that, if retained for 60 days, can constitute a reverse false claims. So that 60-day rule really creates a great new area of potential liability for providers. And that's just one example. There's some other tweaking in the statute in terms of state of mind requirements and other elements of the statutes that also expand liability.
So, Elizabeth, I really appreciate your synopsis of a lot of these developments in fraud and abuse. I want to move on to another area of your expertise, which is the more general policy and law of reimbursement. And there's been a lot of buzz in health policy circles about this two midnights rule, which essentially tries to set up a hard and fast boundary between Part A and Part B reimbursement. I'm wondering if you could comment on the reasons for this rule and how it might be changed.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It has, the two midnight rule has been, as you say, quite a concern in the provider community, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently proposed changes at the beginning of this month to that rule. So there's been lots of excitement about that potential as well. The rule came out of an environment pre-October 1st, 2013, when the two midnight rule was issued. Before that time, providers essentially were left to their own professional medical judgment about the appropriate treatment setting for patients. So, as you mentioned, between an inpatient or outpatient setting, an admitting physician would assess the patient and based on professional judgment decide whether the patient was more appropriately treated on the inpatient side or could be effectively treated on the outpatient side. That state of affairs, that deference to professional judgment, led to some concerns and some difficulties. Those concerns and difficulties were especially acute when Medicare recovery audit contractors became involved and began focusing attention on short-stay hospital admissions. Recovery audit contractors, or RACs, are a type of private entity, essentially a private bounty hunter. The federal government contracts with these organizations to ferret out instances of overpayment, abuse, or fraud in the healthcare system. And these short-stay admissions became an easy thing for the RACs to screen for. A lot of what they do and how they identify improper payments is through some data mining and other sophisticated computer sorting of bills. So it was easy to pull out these short-stay admissions for potential improper payments. Within that, there was concern that providers may have been admitting too many patients for short stays on the inpatient side, which tends to garner a higher reimbursement, as opposed to the outpatient side, which tends to garner a lower reimbursement. So the combination of the RAC aggressive enforcement authority and this ambiguity in the reimbursement methodology led to some real problems in this area. Well, CMS tried to step in and clarify the tension and the stakeholder confusion with the two midnight rule. And what the two midnight rule did, was to set up a presumption that for hospital stays, which the admitting physician expected would span two midnights, those were presumptively properly billed as inpatient Part A higher reimbursement admissions, whereas stays that would not span two midnights were presumptively properly billed as Part B outpatient, typically observation type admissions that garnered a lower reimbursement rate. So the two-midnight rule was intended to provide some clarity to what had been, again, a question of basically medical judgment, but also an area of ambiguity and a focus of RAC audits. But it led to some unintended consequences. One of those unintended consequences is that as providers sought to avoid RAC scrutiny for these short stay admissions, they started admitting more patients as outpatient, even patients who maybe did end up needing more than two nights of care. And that had the effect for patients of making them ineligible for skilled nursing facility services post-admission. And that is because of another rule under Medicare reimbursement, which is that unless you've been in the hospital as an inpatient for more than a specified period of time, you cannot be eligible for the skilled nursing care following your other services. So a number of patients who really properly could have been treated as inpatients and properly did need skilled nursing care upon discharge were no longer able to get those services. Well, CMS made several attempts to address provider concerns, to clarify, to guide the RACs in their fairly aggressive enforcement attempts, but only made some progress in that area. That this question of appropriate treatment setting and the application of the two-midnight rule continued to plague providers and to create a lot of problems in this area. So the recent announcement by CMS in on July 1st of 2015 was essentially to not really scrap the two-midnight rule, but to tweak it. So there's some tweaking in the middle. As a result of this, under the proposed rule, extraordinarily short stays, we might call them, that is less than one midnight, maybe a few hours to one overnight, remain presumptively Part B outpatient services and remain targets of audits. Again, stays that are equal to or exceed two midnights are presumptively properly Part A inpatient services. But in the middle, that is to say, hospital admissions that are less than two midnights but more than a few hours, in that space, the presumption of inappropriateness no longer applies. Those cases will now be assessed on a case-by-case basis, essentially returning to the world of professional judgment that governed this entire question pre-October 2013 when the two-midnight rule was issued. So in some ways, the change is quite minor, but it certainly is significant for the provider community, and I think at least signals a return to deference to professional judgment and also an attempt to address the RAC audits that were quite concerning to providers. Another element of the proposed rule, which goes to that latter point, is that the agency that CMS has shifted enforcement authority for hospital admissions from the RACs to another type of private contractors, quality improvement organizations, or QIOs, which historically have not had much role in fraud and abuse enforcement. They've really been more involved in policy making and monitoring the quality of care to Medicare beneficiaries. So reassigning this admissions question, inpatient versus outpatient admissions question, to the QIOs, I think also signals that same return to some focus on professional medical judgment rather than these more blunt instrument types of screens that the two-midnight rule represented.
Well, thank you for that outline and description and analysis of a very complex area where I can see there are just so many different policy angles and push and pull between the different stakeholders. I was just wondering, you know, I did an article a couple years ago on private deputies and certifiers in Medicare fraud enforcement and some other elements of administering Medicare. What's your sense of the RACs right now? I mean, is there, I when researching that article, I saw some real pushback by the providers against the RACs and some of the the certs, and there's just this veritable alphabet soup of anti-fraud right. contractors. Do you have a sense that that continues to this day, or are things sort of normalizing?
No, I think that's. I think there's still considerable concern about the RACs and the ZPICs and the certs and everything that you mentioned. I mean, this is the RACs in particular, I think, are concerning. And I think part of the reason that they kind of ran away with things with the two midnight rule is that they are truly bounty hunters, and they are paid on a contingency basis. They get 9 to 12.5% typically of any amounts that they recover as overpayments. Some of the other contractors are just paid on a regular contract service rate, so they don't have the same sort of incentive to amass overpayments. But I think from the provider's perspective, there's still a great deal of concern about these different contractors coming knocking on their doors.
So I took a look at the Toomey case, the Fourth Circuit decision from last year, to sort of as a warm-up to this conversation. And I wondered whether it sort of is something of a sort of a poster child for some of the issues that we've been discussing and you teach. There was a complex case in which it looked as though the hospital involved had got a lot of legal counsel about what they were going to do. And in the end of the day, found themselves the wrong end of a $327 million verdict. What pieces of that case are going to be sort of the casebook pieces going forward? Or am I wrong about my sense of its importance?
No, I agree. I think that case is hugely important and hugely troubling, or at least a cautionary tale, I think, for the industry. I mean, that's the hospital at issue is a community hospital. And I think essentially they took this case to the mat instead of settling, as so many of these False Claims Act and bootstrapped Stark or anti-kickback into False Claims Act type cases tend to settle. I think from Toomey's perspective, they already knew what they were up against and really couldn't afford to settle, so they had to roll the dice, and the dice did not come up well for them. So I think it's certainly important to the provider industry about the continuing very high stakes of these types of enforcement actions. And Toomey, quite typically, like many of these, was initiated by a QI-TAM relator, a private whistleblower who brought the action to the government's attention. And that dynamic, I think, is certainly very much still a concern for providers. I think the casebook points, I mean, the reason I'm including it in our new forthcoming casebook in our fraud and abuse chapter is an example of a Stark Law violation involving physician reimbursement. So one of the things I mentioned in my introductory remarks is that a lot of the types of arrangements that we would think of in other industries as perfectly appropriate create the potential for very high stakes and high liability for in the healthcare context. So contracts between employers and employees, or between independent contractors and the entities for which they work, that look in any other industry as perfectly legitimate may be Stark Law or anti-kickback violations in the healthcare industry. So I think the case certainly is a very good illustration of that. It also illustrates, as you mentioned, Toomey bent over backwards in many ways to get legal advice on these very complex laws, to see that the arrangements that they were proposing with physicians would not run awry of the fraud and abuse laws. And maybe part of the problem is that they bent over backwards a little bit too far. I think there was concern by the court that they shopped for an opinion, that they asked several people and didn't get answers they liked and kept asking until they got an answer that they did like. Although much of the expert testimony that they relied on was from a guy named Kevin McEnany, who had actually been in the administration. He had been on the enforcement side of CMS. And told the provider in no uncertain terms that they could not do this, and they went forward anyway. So I think that there's some real risk there and some real lessons in terms of corporate governance about how to proceed when considering these sorts of arrangements, how to inform executives and directors of the potential risks, and you know, what to do with that sort of documentation, and those kinds of governance questions, I think, are really important in the case as well.
So it takes me back many decades to a conversation, I think maybe the first conversation I ever had with someone who was practicing fraud and abuse law in the healthcare field. And I said, well, what exactly do you do? And she said, I explain to healthcare clients why they could go to jail for doing things that every other industry does legally on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, exactly.
So on that note, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Elizabeth Weeks-Leonard. Thanks for joining us, Liz.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. And also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me on Twitter at Nicholas Terry. That's NicolasTerry. And Frank, where can you be found?
Also on Twitter at either at Frank Pasquale or at Health PI.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.